Our next argument this morning is in the matter of United Airlines.
May it please the
Mr.
court.
Mr. Keiselstein.
Mark Keiselstein on behalf of the appellant, United Airlines, Inc. The issue on appeal is whether the facilities lease between the CSCDA and United is a true lease, or rather a component of a pre-petition financing. United sought a declaration in the bankruptcy court that the facilities lease was not a true lease. Judge Weedoff granted summary judgment in favor of United. Judge Darrow reversed that holding and found that the facilities lease was indeed a true lease. The answer to the true lease inquiry will determine whether the CSCDA is entitled to certain unique privileges conferred by Congress exclusively on landlords, specifically the right to timely receive post-petition rent at the contract rate pursuant to Section 365(d)(3) of the Code, as well as the right to reoccupy the property should United fail to assume the facilities lease at some point prior to exit. Therefore, a true lease finding would mean that to continue occupying the premises at SFO, United would have to pay all pre- and post-petition facilities rent, close to $9 million per annum, and could not discharge the obligation to continue doing so for the natural life of the facilities lease, some 28 additional years, through its plan of reorganization. And that rental obligation includes a $154 million balloon payment at the end of term. Conversely, if the facilities lease is held to be a financing, all the facilities rent would simply be pre-petition indebtedness subject to discharge in accordance with the bankruptcy code. Therefore, a false positive on the true lease question would allow the bondholders here to elevate their claims above similarly situated pre-petition creditors to the tune of some $400 million. Now, to address the true lease question, one must examine the underpinnings of Section 365 as well as the facilities lease and the related documents. Now, it's clear that Section 365(d)(3) was intended to protect landlords that provide actual current services post-petition to debtor tenants. Senator Hatch's oft-quoted remarks from the Senate conference and the cases interpreting 365(d)(3) make that clear. Now, the inverse is equally true. A party designated as a landlord that is actually providing no services post-petition, or a sub-landlord that's not liable to the prime landlord, should not be entitled to the benefits of 365(d)(3). Similarly, the assumption rejection choice is one a debtor should only have to make in the true lease context. Now, the bankruptcy code does not define the term lease of real property, but the legislative history to what is now Section 502(b)(6) of the code is instructive in several respects.
Why should we be thinking about the legislative history?
Well, the term lease of real...
Why don't we apply the normal rule of bankruptcy law that these terms take their meaning from state law, that the underlying interests are defined by state law? That's what the Supreme Court said in Butner. It's what it's consistently said ever since. You're making an argument for federal law, and then we get our federal law not out of any federal statute, but by reading legislative history. And that sounds like, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, two illegitimate moves back to back.
Well, two responses. First, it ultimately doesn't matter here if federal common law or California state law apply.
Then why is that the very first argument in your brief?
If
it doesn't matter whether federal law is important, why the extended request to us effectively to ignore Butner?
Well, there's a threshold issue there. For one thing, so the term lease of real property is not self-defining. And in fact, the legislative history directs very explicitly that one distinguishes between...
History can't direct anything. It wasn't enacted by Congress. It wasn't signed by the President. It has no legal force.
Well, I think Judge Weedoff, in the argument below, noted the situation. What if a state declared that every mortgage within its borders would be a lease?
Well, that's an interesting question. And maybe that would be an argument you'd take to the Supreme Court and ask them to overrule Butner. But Butner is the decision of the Supreme Court. We're going to follow it. And maybe we should proceed on that ground.
Okay. The one other thing I would say is that the CSCDA's argument, which relies on the California validation statutes, I believe it exemplifies why federal common law ought to be applied. That statute would completely circumvent an economic substance analysis. It would preclude it by its terms. So that's the example of a rogue state statute that would preclude an economic analysis, which is what I think is required here. But let's turn to California state law or federal law. There's many overlapping elements, and the fact is that under either scenario, this is clearly not a true lease. And I'd like to focus, because there are too many elements to focus on all of them, on two in particular. One, is the rent that's paid under this lease meant to compensate the landlord for the use of the property? And it's very clear here that it does not. First and perhaps foremost,
when you say that's the standard, where is it coming from? Are you now referring to the UCC definition?
No, I'm referring to the cases, the Nightlight Inn case, the PCH case. That's one California case, one state law case that both or federal case that both concentrate on whether the landlord is being compensated for the use of the property or the putative landlord is being compensated for the use of the property. This is admittedly an amalgam given the time, but that is one that's a common factor across the board. Now, the first factor here, if you look at the straight language of the facilities lease at Section 4H, it says, and I quote, payment of the facilities rent is designed to provide CSCDA and trustee funds adequate in amount to pay all the premium, if any, and interest on the SFO bonds. In fact, under the facilities lease, if that amount is not sufficient to pay the bonds, United simply has to pony up additional money. Second, CSCDA, the putative landlord here, does not receive the rent. It is paid directly to the trustee. The CSCDA receives only nominal administrative fees. So again, the landlord's not being compensated for the use of the land. It's hardly being compensated at all. Third, although the facilities rent.
There's a lease on the whole property, right?
There is a underlying ground lease.
And United continues to pay on that lease, right?
Including these 20 acres.
Yeah, and this 20 acres with this arrangement is an overlay on that existing lease, isn't it?
It's superimposed on the existing lease. And one of the important facts here is that United pays a landlord already for the occupancy of this land, the city and county of San Francisco, and has been doing so for over 30 years. I'd also point out that the facility rent here over its natural life would exceed $400 million. But for the site sublease that the CSCDA got from United, it paid a total of $1 for the 36-year site sublease. So it's self-evident that CSCDA is not being compensated for the use of the land, its $1 investment, with a stream of payments of $400 million. This also goes to another one of the factors, whether the CSCDA acquired its interest for fair market value, and it's clear that it did not. Now, obviously, one other fact is that if United were to prepay the rent pursuant to the facilities lease, i.e. retire the bonds, the facilities lease would terminate. Now, that sounds like a mortgage to me. You pay off your mortgage, you have a mortgage burning party, you prepay your lease. Your lease doesn't terminate. You just get to stay in the property without having to pay further rent. There are also other issues here that indicate that the funds being paid have nothing to do with the value of the property. For instance, if the maintenance-based lease were terminated through no fault of United and as part of the inevitable domino effect, the site sublease and the facilities lease were both to fall by the wayside, United would still owe facilities rent to compensate the CSDA for the use of the subject property, even without use of the subject property. And two real-world examples of that, if the maintenance-based lease were terminated because the FAA decided that it wasn't safe to fly into San Francisco so that United could no longer operate its business there, the facilities lease would obviously be terminated once the maintenance-based lease was terminated, but United would still have to pay the facilities rent. That's a hell and high water, or high water condition of this lease, which again is one of the indicators that it is not actually a lease. Similarly, if the subject premises were completely condemned, completely destroyed, such that United could no longer use them, United would still have to pay facilities rent. Clearly, at that point, it's not compensating anyone for the use of the land. It no longer has the use of the land. So if, God forbid, the big one were to hit Northern California and these 20 acres slid to the bottom of the bay, United would still be paying the CSCDA for the use of that property.
Well, the whole point of the CSCDA, whatever it is to create tax-exempt bonds, isn't it?
That is a purpose.
Have that conduit, and then the purchasers of the bonds obviously get tax-free income.
That's correct.
Bonds generate lower rate financing.
That's correct. This is one method of doing it. It's not the only method of issuing tax-free bonds. It's been done other ways elsewhere. In fact, the CSCDA has the authority to do this other than through a lease. I want to talk for a moment about the appraisal that was commissioned by HSBC as part of this litigation. First, it's clear that that appraisal was a post hoc fig leaf. There was no appraisal done at the time these bonds were issued in 1997. The official statement, the prospectus that was shared with investors, said nothing about the fair market rental value of this property. Second, in determining the fair market rental value under this appraisal, the appraisal completely ignored the $154 million balloon payment at the end of term, a balloon payment which I would also add is not typical of a normal lease with monthly rental payments. The fact that it did not take into account that huge balloon at the end obviously skewed the values that it ascribed to the fair market rental use of the property. If that balloon were paid in 2033, that would be the equivalent of the prior 17 years of rental payments. Finally, the appraisal is irrelevant because even if one assumed that the facility's rent and the fair market value were one and the same, it would not change the fact that the facility's rent does not compensate the CSCDA for the use of the subject premises, which is a critical factor here. Another critical factor that I'd like to focus on is the lack of any reversionary interest in the subject premises on the part of the CSCDA. As Judge Weedoff noted, a party can't be a true landlord if it has no interest in the subject property at lease end, no upside and no downside risk. And without a true landlord, obviously you can't have a true lease. Now, Judge Dara believed that proved too much because it would place all subleases outside the purview of Section 365, where the sublease term and the primary lease term were coextensive. But that was an error. First, as we all learned in first-year property law, a sublease is a conveyance of a lesser interest than the entire leasehold interest. A sublease is typically shorter than the primary lease so as to preserve to the sublessor a reversionary interest. Otherwise, it's an outright assignment. Here, the facilities lease and the site sublease run until 2033, even though the maintenance-based lease runs only until 2013. So we have a sublease that's not only not shorter than the primary lease, but it's some 20 years longer than the primary lease, another anomaly that takes us further away from the realm of a true lease. United also can't terminate the facilities lease under any conditions until the bonds are paid. Once the bonds are paid, the CSCDA has no further interest, and the bondholders have been paid in full. Again, no reversionary interest. Unless the court has questions, I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Mr. Johnston.
May it please the court, Jim Johnston on behalf of HSBC Bank USA. It's a privilege to be here. I think it's helpful, Your Honor, to start with the basics because United tends to obscure them. This case is about whether United has to live up to its obligations to pay rent under a lease of property at San Francisco International Airport. The property is not owned by United. The property is owned by the City and County of San Francisco. United doesn't own the property, and it doesn't claim to. But United wants to stay there without paying rent. We simply want United to pay rent or to vacate the property. If you were to read the document at issue in this appeal, the facilities lease, on its own, without the gloss that United puts on it, you'd have to conclude that it's a lease. It gives United the right to possess the property for a term of years. It requires United to pay rent during that term. And this is probably most important. It gives the landlord the right to evict United if it doesn't pay, and then to re-rent the property to somebody
else.
These
are all features of normal sale and leaseback transactions, but of course an awful lot of sale and leaseback transactions are characterized under the Uniform Commercial Code as financing arrangements rather than leases. So this is a question of characterization. Surely you're not going to say that all sale and leaseback transactions as a matter of law must be leaseholds for purposes of 365 just because I've got the word lease in them.
No, absolutely not, Your Honor.
Right. So how is this properly classified under the UCC if we use the standard UCC approach?
If you were to use the UCC, which doesn't apply because this is a real property rather than a personal property issue, but I think the UCC provides a good guide. UCC sets forth a test where the factors are designed to determine whether or not the nominal lessee actually owns the property. The most critical factor under the UCC, and in fact under state law, is whether or not the lessee has the option to acquire the property at the end of the lease term for a nominal sum. In that case, it's clear that what has happened is that the lessee has acquired title to the property for all intents and purposes. The UCC cases also indicate that when the lease runs longer than the useful life of the property, which frequently can happen in the case of an equipment lease, then again, the indicia of ownership reside with the lessee, not with the lessor. That's what the whole lessee test is about. Now, United wants to call this a leasehold mortgage rather than an actual lease. There's a big difference that was missed by the bankruptcy court and that United doesn't address between a lease and a leasehold mortgage. And actually, that's the critical difference in this case. With a lease, which the authority has here, a landlord is able to evict the tenant, take possession, re-rent the property for its own account. With a mortgage, the landlord has to file a foreclosure action, wait out mandatory redemption periods, and sell at a foreclosure sale. The difference is the landlord can take possession quickly, often without the aid of a court, and has tremendous flexibility. A landlord can re-rent to one or more than one tenant. A landlord can improve the property before re-renting it. A landlord can even change the intended uses for the property. The secured creditor has none of those rights. And actually, the difference between eviction and foreclosure is especially pronounced in California, where we have a one form of action rule that dictates that a secured creditor has to proceed by way of judicial foreclosure or else lose all the rights to pursue any deficiency against the borrower. The evidence in this case shows that the authority bargained for the flexibility afforded by the right to re-rent, and that it was a critical component of the transaction. And the basic principle I would submit is one established by this court in the Kasuba case. In that case, the court held that parties can bargain for lease rights in the context of the financing if that's what they actually intend. And that's exactly what happened in this case. In the face of the clear terms of the document, all of the cases say, under California law, under federal law, it doesn't matter. United has a high burden to convince you that the lease isn't really what it says
it is. I don't understand what burdens are in the context of characterizing legal documents.
I think it's a place to start, Your Honor. What I believe the doctrine is intended to say is that you respect what the terms of the document say. And I think there's no question here that the terms of this document say that it's a lease. And the party who comes in and tells and asks the court, disregard what the terms say, call it something else, treat it as something else, has a burden, has a hurdle to get over, has a burden to establish that, in fact, that's not the case. And in this case, the party who put on all the evidence was my client. It wasn't United. All of the evidence in this case confirmed that it really is a lease. It showed that United and the other parties intended to create a lease. It showed that United chose to enter into this lease despite having a number of alternatives for financing available to it. It shows that United filed financial statements and took tax deductions that showed its payments as payments of rent. And the evidence showed that the property would have significant value at the end of the lease term. United had no evidence on any of these points. United cannot simply point to the documents and say it's not a lease, despite the fact
Why
that...
Why not? That's the big question in this case, is what is the right legal characterization of a particular document? Not clear to me you need any evidence other than that document.
Well, Your Honor, I think the right legal characterization...
You may be right about what the right legal characterization is, but I don't, as I say, I don't understand what burdens of persuasion are or what other evidence there is. It's not as if you're going to get people on the stand and have them talk about what they think about this document. We just need to figure out how it's properly classified under 365.
But the right legal characterization, as Your Honor put it, depends on facts. It depends on the facts underlying the document itself. Intent is actually a specific important factor that the cases look to determine what the parties were really intending to do when they signed this document called the lease. So we don't think it's appropriate to just hold up the lease and say, this isn't really a lease. There has to be more to it than that. But that was United's case. United said, this isn't a lease because it was executed in a financing transaction. The purpose was to raise some money. It said, this isn't a lease because the rent is keyed to payments under a loan.
The actual purpose was to raise some money at the expense of U.S. taxpayers. Since United could have raised money by issuing its own bonds, it was borrowing the Development Authority's tax shield, and in order to borrow the tax shield, it had to take a particular form. But there's no doubt that this was a financing transaction and that the people being skinned are other U.S. taxpayers.
Well, Your Honor, there's no doubt that the purpose of the transaction was to raise money on a tax-free basis. The reason why tax-free financing was available was not because it benefited United. It was because it benefited a public entity, the actual owner of the property here, the city of San Francisco, which owned and operated the airport. And California has made a statutory determination that the authority of which the city of San Francisco is a member can issue bonds on a tax-free basis in order to further the public good, in order to improve public property.
Are you saying that there's always this pre-existing lease with the city for the whole property, right?
That is correct.
And then a segment of it is put in. Are you saying there's just an increase in their rent?
Well, actually, United mischaracterizes the facts on that.
I'm not trying to mischaracterize. I'm asking mm-hmm. you, is that in effect an increase in the rent so that to the benefit of the city?
It is an increase in the rent to the indirect benefit of the city, certainly, because the city has the reversionary interest in the property that was improved.
You mean because even though on a different part of the property, they made a lot of improvements. I don't know what they did with that $150 million. They did buildings and things, I guess. So that makes the city indirectly benefits, even though they don't get the money.
Absolutely. And as I mentioned, the city was a member of the authority, what United calls CSCDA, the entity that issued the bonds. These bonds couldn't have been issued if, in fact, the city wasn't a member of the authority. Also, the point I was going to make earlier is that the rent that United pays under the ground lease, the underlying lease, doesn't account for any of the improvements made on the property. So it's not correct to say that United's already paying rent for all this property. United's paying rent for the ground, but it is not paying any rent for the buildings on this 20 acres.
Who built the building?
United built the buildings, I believe.
So they've improved the property substantially for the city.
They did. But United does not have title to the building.
Yeah. I don't know how long their lease is for, but obviously they know that.
The lease is in the record. The ground lease only ran through 2003. It has now been extended during the course of the bankruptcy case, but it only goes out in 10-year intervals, if I remember correctly. I did want to focus in my remaining time on California law because, as we emphasized in our brief, we do think Butner and Powers compel the conclusion that California law provides the rule of decision here. The case that's closest on point under California law is the City of Desert Hot Springs versus County of Riverside case. That case directly refutes United's argument that you can't have an enforceable lease or an enforceable sublease where the lease is executed as part of a financing transaction, or where a loan is payable from rent under a lease, or where rent's calculated as the amount necessary to repay a loan. In that case, the city wanted to finance construction of its city hall. It leased property to a financier for $1, the exact same situation that we have with the authority here. The financier then immediately subleased the property back to the city. The rent under that sublease was based on the cost of construction financed by the sublessor. On those facts, the California court held that the lease and sublease were enforceable as leases. It held the lease-leaseback arrangement as a method of financing construction is not inconsistent with the existence of a lease. And one of the critical things the court looked to was the financier's rights as the sublessor to exercise a lessor's right to evict and relet. It called those the classic rights belonging to a sublessor against a defaulting sublessee. The authority here has precisely those rights. I did want to point out two things that appeared in United's brief and actually today that are misstatements of the facts. First, it's absolutely not true to say that United will possess the leased property here at the end of the lease term, or that United has some residual interest in the property. The fact is that the sublease runs for the entire term of the underlying lease. When the sublease ends, the property will go back to the city of San Francisco, not to United. The second point to be made is that
When the main lease ends.
When the main lease ends, but also when the sublease ends, because the sublease runs for the exact period of time.
If United pays off the bonds, the sublease will end, but the property won't go back to San Francisco. United will still be the tenant on the main lease.
If United happens to pay off the bonds before the term of the facilities lease, but if you assume, as there's no reason not to, that United just pays the rent as called for under the facilities lease, when the facilities lease ends, the property goes back to the city of San Francisco, not United. One other quick point, and then I see my time is running very short. Our expert absolutely did consider and address all of the rent payments required under the lease, including what United calls the Bloom payment at the end. One of the components of our case, which is part of the record on appeal, was a supplemental declaration of our expert that specifically addressed the point.
Thank you, Mr. Johnston.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Dreher.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Jamie Dreher appearing on behalf of the California Statewide Communities Development Authority, here and after the authority. In my brief time, I hope to simply impress upon this Court the strength and applicability of California's statutory validation framework. The case is that, assuming this panel follows Butner...
I must say I don't understand what significance it has. Because United is not contesting the validity of the sale and leaseback. The question here is what the consequences are, how it's classified for purposes of federal bankruptcy law. California can't determine how it's classified for purposes of federal bankruptcy law. The federal bankruptcy jurisdiction is exclusive.
To this extent, I disagree, Your Honor. Section 365...
So you don't think federal bankruptcy jurisdiction is exclusive?
I'm sorry, that's not the part that I disagree with. The portion of your statement I disagree with is the applicability of California law in this instance, because 365 only applies to leases. The question is not whether, quote, a document can be recharacterized under Section 365. The initial inquiry here is, what is this document? It is a lease. In California, pursuant to the validation framework, it is a lease. The other statement I would disagree with is that United is challenging the validity of this document. Specifically, what they are challenging is the requirement that they pay...
In what way are they challenging the validity of the document? They don't deny that it's a legally binding document.
Their
contention is that as a matter of federal law, they have certain rights under the bankruptcy code. It's not that it's not a legally binding document.
In this sense, it is, Your Honor. By this proceeding, they are attempting to...
Let me put my concern in a different way.
Okay.
Your argument appears to be that California has an entitlement to supersede the bankruptcy code. Either through the validation statute or in any other way, it can pass a law that says, if you don't do X within 60 days after making a contract in California, comma, no rule of federal bankruptcy law can excuse payment, period.
Your Honor, that is the stance we're taking, and I don't think it is a matter of California law.
If that's the stance you're taking, it's a frivolous argument.
Your Honor, it's not that California law supersedes the bankruptcy code, it's that it supplies the interpretive framework under which this document should be characterized.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
Three or four quick points, Your Honor. I think counsel's remarks make it clear that they are trying to set up a dichotomy, that if something is either a sale transaction or it's a true lease. That is, United has to have an ability to purchase for a nominal amount at the end of lease term, or else it must be a true lease. And again, the legislative history to 502b6, not mandatory but illuminating, says a lease can be either a sale or a loan, and a purported landlord can be either a seller or a lender. And here we believe they're a lender. As to the reletting provision, Your Honor, I think that actually helps our case. Unlike the typical reletting provision, here, if the CSCDA were to go in and relet the property, they could only keep the proceeds of that reletting up to the extent of the bond indebtedness. So, for instance, if they were to re-enter the property after United's default, discover gold, have this become a latter-day Sutter's Mill so that it's worth billions, most of that upside, and the document says this clearly, would go to United. United has the reversionary interest, the upside. CSCDA
does not. I don't understand that at all. United is a tenant. Why doesn't the San Francisco airport have the upside of finding gold?
Ultimately, they might, although for a period while United was still the tenant under the maintenance-based lease, they would have some quantum of interest.
Allow them to mine gold?
I'd have to. Perhaps
I would be very surprised.
You're probably
if
right.
United could demolish the terminal and open a mine under its lease.
You're probably right about that, Judge.
So it's not United that has that reversionary interest. It's the San Francisco Airport.
Well, again, for some period of time, and put the gold example aside, United could have an interest for some period of time. Ultimately, it's the city of San Francisco's. Mm-hmm. As far as putting evidence in the record, we believe the best evidence.
I assume that to United, the equivalent of gold would be the sudden disappearance of American Airlines and Southwest from the face of the earth. And then United would have the upside interest.
I should probably be more discreet than to acknowledge that in a public forum, Your Honor. But you may well be right. With regard to the documents, we believe those are the best evidence of what the intent of the parties here, and that extrinsic evidence really is not necessary. And finally, as far as Hot Desert Springs goes, we believe that case is inapplicable for a couple of reasons. One, it really dealt with tax issues, and we know that tax can be treated differently. Something could be a lease for tax purposes and not a lease for bankruptcy purposes.
Thank you. Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thanks to you all. The case is taken under advisement. Our next case.